Picture a 6'7" economist standing before Congress in 1979, stone-faced and unapologetic, about to trigger the worst recession since the Great Depression on purpose. Paul Volcker wasn't there to comfort anyone. He was there to break inflation, no matter how many jobs it cost. This moment crystallized a seismic shift that had been building for decades. Economists had moved from basement offices to the commanding heights of power, reshaping every corner of American life. From the prices you pay to the job you hold, from the airlines you fly to the value placed on your very life, market-oriented economists rewrote the rules. Between 1969 and 2008, their ideas didn't just influence policy, they became policy. In the early 1950s, economists were barely tolerated in government. FDR dismissed Keynes as an impractical mathematician. Eisenhower warned against technocratic control. Young Paul Volcker worked as a human calculator in the Federal Reserve's basement with little hope for advancement. But everything was about to change. A small man with large glasses and boyish enthusiasm, Milton Friedman, would lead an intellectual revolution, arguing that open markets represented the best system of human governance, far superior to government intervention. His ideas would move from academic fringe to mainstream dogma with stunning speed, fundamentally altering how Americans work, consume, and live. This was the economist's hour, and we're still living in the world it created. Friedman's first major victory came in an unexpected arena, ending military conscription. In 1967, Martin Anderson, a libertarian economics professor in Nixon's circle, proposed replacing the draft with an all-volunteer military recruited through competitive wages. Friedman argued that forced service violated free market principles. Despite warnings about alienating conservatives, Nixon embraced it, calling the draft one of the severest and most unfair restraints on the free market. Senator Thomas Eagleton warned that ending the draft would make war the business of the poor. He was prescient. The legislation passed, and the last draft call occurred on June 30, 1973. This shift fundamentally changed Americans' relationship with military service. The all-volunteer force, supplemented by equal numbers of contractors during recent conflicts, made war more remote from most Americans' lives. War became a permanent, low-grade conflict commanding little public attention. Friedman had proven that market logic could reshape even fundamental civic obligations, setting the stage for far more ambitious transformations. In December 1933, John Maynard Keynes published an open letter urging Roosevelt to use government spending to stimulate the Depression-ravaged economy. This challenged prevailing wisdom that government borrowing merely shuffled money around. Keynes argued markets wouldn't automatically deliver optimal outcomes. Uncertain businesses would refrain from investing, and people would remain unemployed. His 1936 book revolutionized economics, and by the late 1950s, economists claimed governments could choose from a menu of unemployment and inflation rates. The Kennedy administration embraced this through Walter Heller's tax cuts. Growth surged, unemployment dropped to 3.5%, and by 1965, Time put Keynes on its cover, crediting his ideas for the most sizable, prolonged, and widely distributed prosperity in history. But the triumph proved short-lived. Vietnam War spending overheated the economy, and by the mid-1970s, Americans faced stagflation, simultaneous high unemployment and inflation. The 1973 oil embargo triggered the worst downturn since the Depression. Keynesian economics faltered, and interest in Friedman's counter-revolution grew. His explanation was simple. Unemployment rose because the economy was weak, while inflation persisted because government kept printing money. When Carter appointed Volcker as Fed chairman in 1979, inflation had eroded the dollar's value to 39 cents compared to 1970. On October 6, 1979, Volcker announced the Fed would adopt monetarism, controlling money supply rather than interest rates, to slay inflation regardless of short-term pain. Interest rates climbed above 20%, triggering severe recession. Unemployment reached 23% in auto and 29% in steel. Americans sent Volcker keys to unsold cars and wooden beams from unbuilt homes. By summer 1982, Volcker declared, "The inflationary tide has turned in a fundamental way. As rates fell, the economy rebounded, but median income for full-time male workers wouldn't match 1978 levels for four decades." Ironically, the Fed quietly abandoned monetary targets when Friedman's assumptions proved wrong. Yet Friedman won the ideological war. Central banks now dominated policy, prioritizing inflation control over unemployment. Meanwhile, supply-side economics promised painless solutions through tax cuts. The Reagan tax cuts failed spectacularly. Americans didn't increase savings, and business investment declined despite corporate tax rates falling to negative levels. U.S. Steel used its windfall to buy Marathon Oil rather than upgrade mills. The 1980s saw average annual growth of just 2.2%, slower than the 1970s, while government borrowing reached levels unseen since World War II. In April 1952, AT&T invited rival engineers to learn transistor manufacturing, offering factory tours and publishing complete instructions in Mother Bell's cookbook. This wasn't voluntary. The federal government forced technology sharing to prevent powerful companies from hoarding innovations. Between 1941 and 1959, regulators required over 100 companies to license patents. Forcing IBM to allow others to write software for its computers enabled companies like Microsoft to emerge. This reflected a distinctly American tradition dating to the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, which criminalized market power abuse. But economics transformed antitrust law. Economists persuaded the judiciary to abandon original goals for a single objective: providing goods at lowest possible prices. Robert Bork's influential 1978 book falsely claimed the Sherman Act's original purpose was solely maximizing consumer welfare rather than preventing power concentration. The Reagan administration dramatically shifted enforcement in 1981, halving the antitrust division staff. The meatpacking industry quickly consolidated. By 1992, top firms controlled 71% of the market, up from 25%, resulting in a 35% decline in workers' wages. The Chicago School delivered lower prices for some goods, but cost workers' bargaining power and entrepreneurial dynamism. In the mid-1930s, airlines convinced Congress that competition meant economic anarchy. The Civil Aeronautics Authority licensed 16 carriers and blocked new entrants for 40 years. In the 1960s, Michael Levine discovered Pacific Southwest Airlines, California's unregulated discount carrier, charging half the rates of federal airlines. His 1965 Yale Law Journal article exposed U.S. air regulation as predicated upon erroneous economic assumptions. Senator Ted Kennedy's 1975 hearings revealed dramatic price gaps. San Francisco to Los Angeles on PSA cost $18.75 versus $41.67 for similar distance Boston-Washington flights. Jimmy Carter appointed eccentric economist Alfred Kahn to head the Civil Aeronautics Board, signing airline deregulation on October 24, 1978. Transportation deregulation delivered massive benefits. Logistics costs fell from 18% to 7.4% of GDP. Airline prices dropped 45%. Passenger volume soared. But it transferred wealth from workers to consumers and executives. Truck driver earnings fell 20%, while airline CEO pay jumped from $373,000 to $11.3 million. Deregulation proved economists right about efficiency, but exposed their blindness to distributional consequences. Markets delivered consumer benefits while hollowing out the middle class. Since the 1970s, economic growth stalled for most Americans, while the top 10% increased their income share from 31% to 48%, returning inequality to Gatsby-era levels. The shift from manufacturing to services was inevitable, but the Economist's hour made it unnecessarily brutal. High-dollar policies and inflation obsession accelerated manufacturing's decline, while weakened unions and corporate concentration shifted power to employers. The minimum wage lost 40% of its purchasing power since 1968. The problem isn't markets, it's their imbalanced implementation. Government already protects affluent Americans through licensing and zoning. These protections should extend downward. Research shows people value fairness over pure economic gain. A society's measure isn't the wealth at the top, but the quality of life at the base. Markets remain powerful wealth creators, but efficiency isn't the only value. Sometimes the right answer is slower change, stronger safety nets, and recognizing that losing a dollar hurts more than gaining one pleases. The Economist's Hour delivered consumer welfare gains, but revealed the limits of treating human flourishing as an optimization problem. We can embrace markets without surrendering to them.